song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And if you want to reach any of the shows that are on the website, you would go to penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. It will take you to the radio page, and you will be able to follow directions to get to the podcasts and listen to 100-plus shows that we have online. And this show will be up in a week or two as well. Today's show is a wonderful one. We have Alice Hoffman and Sigrid Nunez. First up is Alice Hoffman. Her first novel, Property Of, was written at the age of 21 while she was studying at Stanford and published shortly thereafter by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Since then, she has published a total of 16 novels, 2 books of short fiction, and 8 books for children and young adults. Her novel, Here on Earth, an Oprah Book Club Choice, was a modern reworking of some of the themes of Emily Bronte's masterpiece, Wuthering Heights. Practical Magic was made into a Warner film starring Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman. And Alice Hoffman's recent books include Aquamarine and Indigo, novels for preteens, and the New York Times bestsellers The River King, Blue Diary, The Probable Future, one of my favorites, Illumination Night, and The Ice Queen. Green Angel, a post-apocalyptic fairy tale about loss and love, was published by Scholastic, and The Foretelling, a book about an Amazon girl in the Bronze Age, was published by Little Brown. Her newest novel, Skylight Confessions, concerns one family's secret history, and she divides her time between Boston and New York. Let's bring her on. Hi, Alice.
Hey, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on the show. As I said, I've been aware of your work, and I've read much of it over the years. So many of your books have such a, I don't know, magical quality or fantasy, fairy tale quality, and Skylight Confessions is no different. It's a wonderful novel, and I'm so curious how it came about.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I grew up reading folk tales and fairy tales, and I had a Russian grandmother who told me about her past as though it were a fairy tale. So I think I kind of incorporated that into real life even before I was a writer, and it just seemed, you know, to me it seems just part of the literary tradition. So Skylight Confessions has a ghost in it, but it's not, you know, Casper. It's the kind of ghost that can haunt you if you can't let go of the past.
Mm. And so in terms of theme, you deal with difficult themes at times in your books, and I'm curious about that. I'm curious, I know you've gone through difficult times yourself, and I'm curious how that is to bring that into your fiction.
Well, it's a funny thing, you know, I think when you're writing, I think I'm a very subconscious writer, and I, even though I plan out books and I make outlines and I have big poster boards and index cards, in the end, I really don't know what I'm writing about until I write it. And I think that's what makes it interesting for me. So I had no idea what I was writing about with Skylight Confessions until I was about a third of the way through, and then a very shocking thing happened. One of the major characters died, and that really surprised me. And then I had to really think about what the book was about. I had to stop and rethink about what I was writing.
So before you began it, you had, like you said, you had it sort of plotted out in terms of what you thought was going to happen?
Yeah. But I really don't know what's going to happen, because it really, I think when I'm writing, I really feel like it's like a dream state. And what comes out, it's not autobiographical, but it's the way, you know, a dream state really encompasses everything you think and feel, and you're really all of the characters. And I think that's what happens to me during the process of writing. So it's a kind of a discovery for me, which is what makes it interesting for me and why I keep doing it.
Now, I read somewhere in an interview with you that you get up at 5 in the morning.
You know, I used to. Well, I used to when I had another job and when I had small children. And I always think, you know, women with small children really get a lot accomplished. They somehow manage to, like, fit everything in. Now my kids are grown up, and I'm much lazier than I was, so I don't get up at 5 o'clock. But I think it's a really good idea to write every day at the same time if you can. For me, that was extremely helpful. It was like a real job. It wasn't a decision, you know, should I write, shouldn't I write? I just did it every day.
Interesting. Okay, because we were having a conversation earlier about this, about how so many writers get up at 5 in the morning, and that can be exhausting after a while.
But you know something, I think you're close, you're without a censor at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're more free. I think that you're either an early morning 5 o'clock person or you're a late night drinking person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the drinking does the same thing as the dreaming. you know, kind of frees people up.
Interesting. Well, that's encouraging. Now, how have things changed since you started writing? Because you have been so prolific over the years. I mean, your first book was published at the age of 21. Now, this book, apparently, is this the 30th anniversary?
This is my 30th year? Anniversary, yeah.
So how have things changed? I mean, has your process changed much other than the time, you know, the time you write?
Well, I think my process has changed a lot. I mean, just the technology has changed. You know, I started out writing longhand, and then I was on a typewriter, then I was on an electric typewriter, then a computer. You know, I mean, everything keeps changing. I mean, that's what makes it interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everything about it has changed for me. But, you know, the thing that stays the same is that every time I start a novel, I feel like I don't know how to write a novel. I don't remember how to do it. I don't know how I ever did it. And I kind of have to relearn the process every time of how you make a novel.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI with Alice Hoffman, author of Skylight Confessions, published by Little Brown. Well, that brings up something else, which is, again, something I must have read in an interview, and that is that after you had been publishing for a while, you experienced writer's block.
Yeah,
talk
I did. I didn't believe in it until I had it.
What happened?
So, well, what happened for me, it happened twice. Once when I left a publishing house, left an editor, and I just felt really, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen with my future. Oh, actually, it happened three times. And then it happened again when my sister-in-law was very ill and she was dying, and I felt like, what is the point of writing?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to write anymore. And then it happened again after 9/11. When again I thought, you know, what is the point of writing? And each time I had to find my way back to what the purpose of fiction is, you know, what purpose it serves in our lives. And, you know, each time I was lucky enough to rediscover it.
Huh. So interesting. I mean, what can you talk at all about what brought you back, how you were able to find meaning in fiction, and what ultimately drew you back in?
Yeah, well, after 9/11, when I really felt extremely hopeless, like I think a lot of people did, I somehow, you know, subconsciously was smart enough to go back to the books that I had loved as a child, and just to kind of like refresh myself. And I'm a huge Ray Bradbury fan, and really, really loved him when I was growing up. And I read A Fahrenheit 451, which totally reminded me how important, you know, that's about a society where books are burned, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, always in a repressive society, the books are the first thing to go. And, you know, people are so dedicated to books, they're willing to die for books. They're willing to, you know, memorize the books that they love. And it reminded me how important fiction can be in your life. And I was able to write again, and I wrote a book for teens called Green Angel then, which is really about how to write yourself back to life after tremendous loss.
Hmm. Going to have to find that one. Wow. You have certain titles here that I, for some reason, are not aware of. So I'm looking forward to digging out more of your books. It's
good.
Wonderful. Will you read to us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. I'll read a part of Skylight Confessions. It begins with the death of the main character's father. Her name is Arlen, and she's only 17, and she is kind of at a crossroad in her life, and it's at the beginning of the book.
Okay.
Arlen held onto the porch banister and leaned out over the azaleas. She was an optimist despite her current situation. She was young enough not to see a glass as half empty or half full, but as a beautiful object into which anything might be poured. She whispered a bargain as though her whispering could make it true. The first man who walks down the street will be my one love, and I will be true to him as long as he's true to me. She turned around twice and held her breath as a way to seal the bargain. She wore her favorite shoes, ones her father had bought for her in Connecticut, leather slippers so light she felt as though she were barefoot. She felt her aloneness inside her, but she was hopeful too. The past was done with. Now she was made out of glass, transparent and clear. She was an instant in time, One damp evening, two stars in the sky, a line of soot. She had convinced herself that her future would arrive on the street where she'd lived her whole life if only she'd wait long enough and if she trusted in fate. In the living room, people spoke about her as though she had died right along with her father. She wasn't a pretty girl after all, just plain and freckly. She had a high school diploma, and as far as anyone could tell, no particular skills. One summer, she'd worked in an ice cream shop, and in high school, she'd had a dog washing service. People felt pity, but as everyone knows, that isn't an emotion that lasts very long. A low horn sounded as the ferry came across the water from Bridgeport. The fact that there would be fog tonight was discussed as the women cleaned up, wiping off the table, putting away the pound cakes and the casseroles before going out to the porch to say goodnight to Arlen. It was a heavy, salt-laced fog that had settled, the kind that circled lampposts and street signs and made folks lose their way. The neighbors assumed that once they left, Arlen would go inside her empty house. She would walk along the hall where her father's coat still hung on the rack and then take the flight of stairs he hadn't been able to manage for the past 6 months. She would edge past his silent room. No more coughing all night long. No more calls for water. But she stayed where she was. Her father had said to prepare for the future, and Arlen was ready and willing. Her destiny was sure to come to her in her darkest hour, and that was now. It took some time, but after 3 hours, her faith was rewarded, and by then the fog had turned to a light rain, and the streets smelled like fish. A car stopped. There was a young man inside, lost, on his way to a party. When he got out to ask for directions, Arlen noticed he was taller than her father, and she liked tall men. As he approached, he shouted, "Hello." His voice was not what she expected. It was flat and nasal. But that didn't matter. Anything could happen now.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Alice Hoffman reading from Skylight Confessions, published by Little Brown. I read this book quickly. I enjoyed it so much. And I was thinking along the way how, because it's sort of a, metaphysical things happen in the book. I don't want to talk about exactly what does happen, but I was thinking as I was reading it how you set up the rules for writing about things that happen in your book. I mean, it's, you know, it's not exactly the things that happen, I don't know that we can say they're reality-based, and yet it's not science fiction, but it's a certain sort of fantasy fairy tale. Ghost story.
You know, I always think of my books as, you know, when I think of them, I think of them as emotional mysteries.
Mm.
You know, they're the mystery of, you know, who are these people? How do they get to be this way? How do they, why do they feel the way they feel? And I think, you know, it's told in kind of in a symbolic, mythic way, but, you know, just the way fairy tales are told in a symbolic way, but they're really about the psychology of everyday things.
Mm-hmm. So are you, when you're setting up your book, are you setting up rules or are you doing any sort of research so you can, you know, not have anyone nail you on, that could never happen. It could never happen like that. Or are you just setting up your reality for the story and that's that?
You know, it's a funny thing. First, I don't believe in rules and I really don't believe in them in fiction, but I do think that you have to, in the very beginning of a piece of fiction, you have to create a situation where your reader is able to make a leap. I mean, first of all, it's just marks on a page, so you have to, you know, your reader has to be willing to believe that there's going to be a story inside of these all these marks on a page, and that there are going to be people inside these pieces of paper. So already, as soon as somebody picks up a book, you can be pretty assured that they're going to be willing to make a certain leap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think just like in a fairy tale, when you know, somebody tells you that a bear arrives on the door, at, you know, at the point that that happens, I think you're ready to believe that that bear can talk. You know, you go with the story if you believe in the storyteller.
Yeah. So do you research for your books?
You know, I researched certain things. I, you know, for instance, I wrote a book called The Ice Queen, and it was about lightning. And I did a lot of research about lightning, which was really fascinating. And everything in the book, other than what happens to the two main characters, was based on fact. And, you know, that was very interesting. But very often I'll do the research after I write a book because it seems pretty secondary to me because I really want to write about the emotions, you know. When I wrote Illumination Night, which you mentioned, takes place in Martha's Vineyard, and I had never been to Martha's Vineyard, and that didn't seem to matter. I went after I wrote the book, and it seemed just the way I imagined it.
Yeah, research can really hang writers up, I think, in terms of keep them trapped in researching so that they can put off the writing.
I think so, although some people love it, and that's part of the thrill for them, and that's part of what makes it interesting for them. You know, for me, it's pretty secondary.
Mm-hmm. What about revision? Now, how, for instance, was your first chapter always your first chapter? Or did it change once you went into the rewrite? And then what is that like for you? Do you revise as you go along, or do you get a first draft down, barrel through the first draft, and then go back?
You know, it really varies. I've written so much that sometimes it's one way, sometimes it's another way.
What about this book, Skylight Confessions?
Well, here's the thing. I'll confess to you, Barbara, I don't remember writing first drafts.
Really?
I don't. I have no memory of it.
That's nice.
I think I'm really in an altered state, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of revision, and I really believe that you have to start from the beginning. I don't like the idea that because we have word processors now, we can just, like, move things around. And, you know, I always say to people starting out that I really think that writing has a rhythm and you have to start from the beginning all over again. And I do that several times. I do a lot of revision, but I really don't pay attention to how it starts. It's really, it just kind of happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I set the stage for everything. You know, I make the notes, I think about the characters, but when it really gets down to the actual writing, I couldn't tell you when I wrote this. I couldn't tell you where I was when I wrote this. I couldn't tell you any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's true for other writers or not, but it's certainly true for me.
Mm-hmm. What about the voice and the point of view? I have Skylight Confessions before me as well as Illumination Night.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I still have a hard copy of Illumination Night, which I'm totally jazzed about. And they're both in a third person, sort of, I don't know, close, and yet there's a sort of, again, that fairy tale kind of mythic quality sense about them. Is that the voice you most like, or does it just depend on the book?
You know, it depends on the book. Sometimes I really like to write in first person. I always feel, in a way, I'm cheating a little bit because it seems like so much fun to write in first person. And Green Angel is in first person. A lot of times I write teen books in first person because they're so emotional. I really like to, you know, kind of break rules and move around inside people's heads, which is what they tell you never to do in a lot of writing classes. But I love to do that, and I just wrote an introduction to a Virginia Woolf novel, To the Lighthouse, and I, you know, had read it years and years ago, and I was shocked to really discover how fluid she was and how moving back and forth inside people's heads, and it's just really fun to do.
Yeah, I'm more liking third person for that reason. You know, it's especially. Writers who do it well. With Skylight Confessions, you did it so well. It was pretty seamless going from one point of view to another. And, you know, I kept waiting for new chapters, but it wasn't structured that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think sometimes, you know, I start out with a structure, but the structure can change. You know, that's also fluid.
Might you start a book in first person and switch it to third?
Never.
So it begins one way and it's that way.
Yeah, and and when I hear about writers who have done that and changed that, I think it's like writing another book.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to really quickly ask you about writing, being a screenwriter, and how different is that from working on your fiction?
It's really different. I did it for about 25 years. The first thing I ever wrote was made into a movie. It was a very little movie. It was called Independence Day.
Sure, I've seen that.
Yeah, not the Will Smith one, but the Diane Wiest one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for 25 years. I did one or two a year, and nothing was ever made. And I did it to support my novels and my family, and it was fun and interesting, and I worked with fascinating people. But, you know, as a writer, you're just, you know, the fun part is that it's collaborative, and the bad part is that it's collaborative. So, you know, and as a novelist, you're in charge of everything, at least while you're writing it. Then, you know, you give it to the world or you give it to your publisher, and, you know, anything can happen. But during the time you're creating it, you know, no one is telling you what to do, what they think, and no one's boyfriend is reading it and giving them you their ideas. And, you know, it's just a very different process.
Yeah. Now, you said nothing was ever made. The first one was Independence Day. So would your screenplays constantly get optioned? And
Well, I would get hired to write things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would write them, and then they wouldn't get made.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
I think they think of it as research and development, and it, you know, it seems like a lot of a waste of time, but you
right.
know, that's just the process.
Yeah. Any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening?
Well, you know, all I can say is that, you know, I think the best way to write is to write. I think you have to really do it, and I think you have to. A friend of mine who teaches writing said that she always tells her students that inspiration is for amateurs. And I think what she means by that is that, you know, you just have to get up every day and do it as though it was a job. Because I think if you wait for inspiration, you can wait a really long time. And I believe that you have to write your way into fiction.
I like that. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
For taking the time.
Thank you.
That was Alice Hoffman. I wish we had more time. Her book, her most recent book, is Skylight Confessions, published by Little Brown, and take a look. Take a close look at this book. It's a wonderful one. When we return, Sigrid Nunez will be here with Marie Stone. I'm going to take off, so please stay tuned, and do not go anywhere.
Information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signal's Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signal's Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals, Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, California, and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as Barbara mentioned in the first half hour, we are podcasting. This show will join about 110 other interviews up on the web and available for you any time of the day or night. So feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. Barbara and I are sharing the host chair this evening, and I'm Marie Stone, stepping in as your host for the second half hour. And I'm joined now by Sigrid Nunez. Sigrid has published 5 novels, A Feather on the Breath of God, Naked Sleeper, Mitz, the Marmoset of Bloomsbury, For Rowena, and The Last of Her Kind. Her work has also appeared in several anthologies, including 2 Pushcart Prize volumes and 4 anthologies of Asian American literature. A new edition of Mitz is scheduled for publication in the spring of this year by Soft Skull Press. Feather on the Breath of God was a finalist for both the Penn Hemingway Award for First Fiction and the Barnes & Noble Discover New Writers Award. It also received the Association for Asian American Studies Award for Best Novel of the Year. Mitz is a mock biography of Virginia and Leonard Woolf's pet monkey, and it won the Richard and Hina Rosenthal Foundation Award for the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Sigrid Nunez has also been the recipient of a Whitting Writers Award and of a residency from the Lannan Foundation, as well as numerous other awards and sources of recognition. But her latest work is the primary discussion of our subject of our discussion this evening, The Last of Her Kind, published by Picador, came out at the end of last year. It tackles issues of race, class, mental illness, rape, and so much more, and it deals with them head-on, often in controversial and uncomfortable scenes that will engage the reader to challenge their own morality, test their own comfort zones, and should stimulate some fascinating discussion this evening. Sigrid, welcome to the show. Are you there? Sigrid, are you with us? And she is not. Let us see if we can get her back on the line. Hold on just a moment here. She was with us just a moment ago, but she has left us for a moment. Hold on just a moment. We'll see what we can do to bring her back on. In the interim, we'll enjoy a little bit of music. Hold on just a moment, and we'll get her back on the line. Thank you.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of...
And we are back with Singrid Nunez. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Excellent, excellent. I'm sorry we lost you there. I don't quite know what happened. But it is such a pleasure to be able to speak with you tonight, and I enjoyed your book so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had read it over the holidays with my family, and you know, between the Christmas dinner and the turkeys, I couldn't pry myself away from it. Everybody was saying, you know, where did she go? And I was so engrossed with your characters and with the storyline, and at the same time, you know, it's such a hard book, you know, particularly for those of us in Orange County, which, you know, it's a fairly privileged environment. It's a hard book, and it's an uncomfortable book to read, and it's so engaging. Can you talk about first about the genesis of the book, about where the idea began?
Well, for starters, I always wanted to write something about freshman roommates, because even though it's something that a lot of people have done, you know, an experience a lot of people have shared, it hasn't been written about that much. And I just thought that it would be a very rich thing to write about, particularly if I set the meeting of the young women in the late 60s, early 70s, because I also had always wanted to write about that era, which is the era in which I myself came of age. Mm. So I thought I would, you know, take these two characters and put them in that time and place, and I'd be able to tell a lot about that era by following their lives over a period of time.
In many ways, this felt like a writer book in a way, particularly in terms of structure and form. And, you know, my sense is that if I sat down to try to write an outline of this novel, it would be enormously complicated. In terms of organization and structure, how did you approach this project?
Well, I actually think of it as a fairly straightforward tale, because it begins in 1968 with these young women meeting, and then it follows them through school, and then follows the very different paths that their lives took, and certain meeting points that bring them back into each other's lives over a period of time. And basically, it's the narrator, Georgette. It's written in first person from her point of view, and she's looking back from around the year 2000, 2001 at these years that have passed. So, you know, I thought it had a fairly, you know, clear storyline.
Mm. Did you write it in a linear way?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes.
Good. And was there ever any debate in your mind about whose perspective the story would be told from, either from Georgette or Anne's perspective?
Not really, because I knew that Anne was the much more difficult character, much more complicated, and that I really wanted to tell her part of the story also from the point of view of somebody watching her from outside.
And she raises so many complicated issues, and she, you know, at times I, you know, wanted to jump into the book and strangle her, and at times I understood where she was coming from. Anne, yes.
Well, yeah, because I think that Anne Drayton is an extreme version of a type that was very, very common in the late 60s. She's extremely idealistic. She's also overwhelmed with guilt about having been born into a world of privilege, to a degree that is both self-destructive and destructive. And she is so guilty about her own what she calls white skin privilege that she takes a lot of it out on her parents. In a sense, she has to demonize them in order to live with herself. But that, you know, there were so many people at that time who shared that point of view, and they grew out of it. They grew older and they changed. And I thought it would be interesting to try to tell the story of someone who actually didn't change, who held on to those 60s ideals
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and prejudices as well.
Right, right. And there's, you know, there's such a vivid and visceral sense of the 60s throughout this book, the physical details, but also as you're talking about, the mindset of this is so viscerally the 60s. How difficult was it for you to get in touch with that for such sustained periods of time, and to be in your office living it and breathing it and thinking about it, and then, you know, to look up and it's 2004, 2005. How difficult was that transition for you as a writer?
Well, whenever you're writing a book, no matter, you know, even if it isn't something that takes place in a different time, you're always living in two different realities when you're writing a book, the reality of your own experience at that time and the reality of the book. And so, you know, I wanted to have a really strong sense of what it was like at that time. I wanted to have that authenticity, and so I had to really, you know, bring in all the details, the music and the clothing that people wore, and above all the ideas that they had. And since I did come of age during that time, it wasn't difficult for me. I didn't have to do a lot of research. I enjoyed it in the sense that there was something about looking back. I hadn't looked closely at all that myself, because you don't unless you're writing about it. So for me, it was a way to revisit my own past, and I found it very, very stimulating.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
Yes. Why don't I read the opening page of the novel?
Perfect.
And as I said, this is Georgette speaking. Georgette comes from a very poor, disadvantaged family from way up north, New York State, on the Canadian border. And Anne, her roommate, comes from a very, very privileged family as an only child from New England. We had been living together for about a week when my roommate told me she had asked specifically to be paired with a girl from a world as different as possible from her own. She did not want a roommate from the same privileged world in which she had been raised, she said. She did not want a roommate who had been raised as she had been, but this was my thought, not hers, to believe you could make this kind of special request and expect it would be granted. I, for example, would never have believed that I could have had any say in my choice of roommates. I did remember receiving some forms from the college housing office that summer and answering such questions as, "Do you mind rooming with a smoker?" But that I could have filled the blank half page under comments with something like, "I want a roommate from this or that background," would never have occurred to me. "No," I wrote. "I did not mind rooming with a smoker, even though I was not a smoker myself. I had no preferences of any kind. I was completely flexible. Though I had done well in high school, I had never taken it for granted that I would go to college. No one in my family had done so before me. That I had managed to get into not just any college, but a good one, remained a little overwhelming. I left the space under comments blank. I had no comment to write unless it was to say, thank you for accepting me. And when my roommate told me what she had done, it brought me up sharp. How exactly had she phrased it? What words had she used to describe me?
Mm. I'm sorry, keep going.
No, that's fine. Yeah.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful. This might sound like a weird question, perhaps, and I hope I ask it in the right way. But you're in the novel as an author for a period of years, and then you send it off into the ether of the universe and kind of wait. And it's, you know, it's digested by however many thousands of readers, and they filter it through their own experiences of race and class and whatnot. And then it comes back to you in the form of questions or interviews like this or reviews of the book. Do you experience your own work differently when it returns to you than you did before you released it?
Not exactly. I guess it's there. I mean, there is a kind of before and after, and of course you're very much I guess I would just say that once you know that once you've written it, it's not quite yours anymore, and you don't have the same relationship to it because it is out there. But I don't, for me anyway, nothing about the work changes because of what someone else has written about it or asked me about it or anything like that. It's just that it's part of, you know, the world out there as opposed to being just this private thing that I'm working on.
Mm. You view it in the same way as you always did, regardless of how other people might interpret it.
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, I take into account, I mean, it's of interest to me how people interpret it, but that can't really change the work itself, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
I do, yeah. How long does it take you to, because this creates such a world and such a time, and how long does it take you to kind of extract yourself from that once the novel is done? Are you able to let these characters go, or do they, you know, sort of haunt you for a period of time? Or, you know, how long does it take you to move on to your next project?
Well, you know, I hear that from other writers, this thing about being haunted by the characters and sad at letting them go, and I don't quite share that. I really feel that when I have, you know, invented characters, I have a story to tell about them, and I write the book, and I tell the story, and then I feel that I've done that. I've finished that. I'm able to let go. Sometimes people ask me, "Haven't you been tempted to return to them or to some other characters in the book in another book?"
Mm-hmm.
And as some writers have done. And the answer is no, I've never been tempted to go back. I really feel that it's about a particular story each time I write a book that I want to tell. And I don't have a great mourning for the characters when they go. I do feel at loose ends in a certain way, when I've finished a big project. But then I start something else. I start thinking about something else, or, you know, I usually start writing another book, you know, immediately after finishing one. So,
Do the ideas come to you fairly easily for the next one?
Well, I think it was I.B. Singer who said, you know, if you're a doctor, the good Lord sends you sick people, and if you're a writer, the good Lord sends you stories. I think that the hardest part about writing is actually, you know, the hard labor of actually writing a novel. It is, you know, it is a lot of hard work, I guess, but actually coming up with ideas, that's not so difficult. I start out with the character. I start out with a character that I want to talk about, or more than one character. And once I know who my characters are going to be, who my main characters are, then I need to, you know, tell their story and put them in a certain situation and people their world and give them things to do and things to think and experiences to have. And the story, you know, pretty much grows out of getting to know the characters.
Now, I'd heard you in conversation, I think, with Elizabeth Benedict, and you were talking about how your publisher forced you, or as part of this process, you were asked to do an outline of this novel. Although you didn't feel, you know, committed to the outline once you wrote it, you just kind of had to, you know, to give him something. So I assume that you normally would not outline a work. You just kind of take it where it goes.
Well, the thing is that what you're presenting to the publisher is a chapter or two and an outline in order to get a contract. So that's what I meant about ending up having to write an outline of my novels, in order to sell them and get the contract. But the idea is that I don't really know if that's how the story is going to happen, because I write you know, a little bit at a time, and then I move on. I write the beginning, and then I continue, and then I move on and on and on, so that everything in the story grows out of what's come before. I don't write, as some writers do, a whole big outline and then go back and revise it. So I do try to give the editor a very general idea about, you know, what's going to happen, but I can't be held to it because I don't really know what's mm-hmm. going to happen in any book that I write.
Sure. You know, you deal with so many hard topics in this, and you really hit them head on, and it's, you know, at times it's uncomfortable, I think, for the reader to kind of challenge their own way of thinking of things, and, you know, race and class and mental illness. Is it uncomfortable for you as the writer in the writing of it? Do you find yourself struggling with those issues alongside of them, or is it a fairly organic experience?
Well, when you're, you know, I think, you know, as I said, the actual labor of telling a long story, of writing a book, you know, it's just fraught with all kinds of difficulties. You know, you start something that doesn't work, and, you know, you make mistakes, and you have to think everything through. And, you know, anytime you're writing a novel, you know, in general, you're dealing with people and their relationships and how they're living their lives and their struggles and so on. And, you know, that's the novelist's job, to be able to present these people not as if they were just, you know, names on a page, but people whom you would actually meet in real life. And people that you meet in real life have, you know, difficult lives and all kinds of things going on. They've got, you know, they might have someone in their family who's ill, they might have someone who's imprisoned, or someone who's off fighting the war. And it's the novelist's job to investigate all that and to capture those experiences, you know, as effectively and as honestly as possible. And sure, there's a certain amount of you know, whatever, struggle in that, but I don't really think of it that way. I just think I'm just trying to, you know, get it all down, tell a good story, create these living characters.
Mm. Well, it was done so effectively. It really was.
Thank you.
Revision. What's the process of revision like for you when you finish that first draft? How do you go back to tackle it the second time?
Well, I don't. My process is that I begin to write a story, and I get a few pages going, and then I try to make those pages as close to perfect as I can, and then I move on a little bit further, and so I'm usually working on a section of about 15 pages at a time, and I just keep going on and on and on. So by the time I come to the end of a book, I don't need to do that kind of revision, because I revise every page and every paragraph like as I'm going along.
Mm.
You know, I know other writers who do it the other way. They get the whole big story down and then they go back, but I don't do that.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. We were in the first half hour, we were having the debate about kind of physically how you write and the you know, the time of day, and we were talking about the magic that exists either at 5 in the morning or in the middle of the night, where there's this kind of unrestrained maybe magic in the darkness. Is that your experience, or you know, can you kind of keep more regular hours?
Well, I write every day, but I think that really, I think that, that what happens is that you, when you're writing, you know, when you like other kinds of work, when you get very deep into it and your concentration is very good, it doesn't really matter what time of day it is or night or whatever, but when you're really, really involved in the work and you're working hard and you're thinking hard, that's you know, if there's any magic in it. I've always been struck by this quote by the artist Chuck Close, who says, "Inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just go to work." And, you know, writing is my job, and it's you know, it's work. And when it's going well, you know, it gives me a very good feeling. But it's not really tied to any kind of ritual or structure. It's just something that I do every day. My main concern is trying to tell an interesting story.
Going back to the work, I recently heard that you came to writing later, a little bit later in life. What was your path like to writing?
I didn't really come to writing later in life. I've written since I was a little girl. Mm-hmm. Most writers I know, wrote when they were children. I didn't publish my first novel until I was 42.
Mm.
But I'd always written. I'd written shorter things. There was a period of time when I was in high school when I thought that I wanted to be a dancer. I mean, I would have loved to have done that, and I was studying ballet. And so for a little period of time, I thought, no, I'm not going to be a writer. I'm going to be a ballet dancer. But I knew that I was going to be a professional writer. I mean, at least I hoped so. By the time I left college, and I always took, creative writing courses and, in school and so on. But, I just happened to publish my first novel fairly late. Mm. I mean, and in fact, I don't even know how late it is because a lot of people publish their first novels, at that age.
No, that's not, I wouldn't say that was fairly late, no.
Yeah.
No. Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. Do you have any advice or parting wisdom for our writing listeners out there?
Well, I think that the way that you learn best how to write is really by finding these writers whose work you really love, and when you read it, you think, I'd like to get something like that into my own work, and then just reading as much of that writer as possible, and also this just, this working, trying to, actually work every day. Mm. That would be, as Virginia Woolf said, it's like playing the piano, practicing, you have to practice every day.
Very good advice. Well, Singrid, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this evening. This was such a delight.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Singrid Nunez reading from her, talking about her latest work, The Last of Her Kind. It's available online and in bookstores now and published by Picador. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this evening. Before I go, I'll share with you a brief quote from someone wise out there, though no one knows quite who they are, but they observe that a blank page is God's way of showing you how hard it is to be God. I will be back with you next week in conversation with Chris Abani and his new novel, The Virgin of Flames, and Nora Vincent discussing her foray into manhood in Self-Made Man. So until next time, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Have a great night. Than to see you walk away from me, child.